Well, I just wanted to start by talking about the headlines. This morning I looked at my phone and there were two that stuck out to me. One is that in Gaza City, 1 in 5 children is facing like acute malnourishment. To put that into context, Gaza City is like the best off place in Gaza to be. It's the last place that there's basically any civilian infrastructure left. It's the place that Israel is targeting with invasion at the moment. And the second headline is that families in Gaza are drinking water that makes them sick. There's a heat wave right now in Gaza. The thirst is, you know, weighing on people. And they know that the water that they're drinking, that they have access to in the long term, might kill them. But they have no other choice but to drink it and to give it to their children. I think any day of the year, headlines like that would be a shocking atrocity. And yet, we've seen headlines like that every single day for 700 days. I was reflecting, well, more than 700 days. Last year at this conference, the headline that had stuck out to me was the fact that a man with newborn children had gone to pick up their birth certificate, and when he arrived home, he found his whole family and his two newborns are buried beneath the rubble of his house. That was the headline last year, and now it's starvation. Now it's people getting sick from tainted drinking water and so on. And it's just day after day after day. That is what is happening in Gaza. This is going to scar, and it should scar our minds forever. It's just like heinous what is happening. It's profoundly distressing to look at it. You can only imagine what it's like for the Palestinians who are suffering through it. And I think seeing this puts an obligation on all of us to ask, what kind of society not just allows something like this to happen, but enables it to happen, and commit ourselves to fighting relentlessly against that type of society until we have one that is fit for ordinary people to live in? I think that that society is called capitalism. It's capitalism which arms, which funds, which justifies, and I think which ultimately motivates the atrocities that are taking place in Gaza at the moment. And to sort of prove this, I wanted to start by talking about Israel's global enablers. I think capitalism is to blame for the genocide in Gaza in a literal and direct sense. Sometimes Israel is described as a rogue state that's going outside the international law and so on. But actually, Israel's crimes are committed and enabled directly by an international network of capitalist institutions without which it would basically be impossible for them to get away with what they're doing. To start with, it's hard to look past the United States, which is basically the international symbol of capitalism without any rival. Since the genocide in Gaza began, Israel has received more aid from the United States than any other year in its existence. In the 12 months after October 7, Israel got $18 billion, which is about 30 billion Australian dollars, in aid from the United States. That included direct transfers of military equipment like laser-guided missiles, bombs, artillery shells. And in the first 6 weeks of the bombing campaign alone, 10,000 tons of weaponry were shipped for direct use in Gaza. The United States has an exclusive weapons stockpile for Israel. It's called the War Reserve Stock Allies-Israel, which is designed to help Israel in times of great need, like when it runs out of bombs to drop on civilians. Billions more weapons have been purchased from the United States with Israeli money, not just aid money. So over, you know, Biden in August 2024 approved $20 billion US in arms sales for jets, for shells, for missiles. The US during World War II was like, you know, somewhat spuriously named the arsenal of democracy, but I think it's safe to say today the United States is the arsenal of genocide. Beyond just the direct military aid that the United States provides, American companies line up to sell arms, weapons of mass destruction, to the Israelis. So just like corporations like IBM, Hugo Boss, Audi, Bayer lined up to assist and profiteer off the Holocaust of the Jewish people, today's industrial behemoths are lining up to put their snouts in the trough of genocide in Gaza. Companies like Lockheed Martin, which does research at my university, is perhaps like one of the most notorious. Its stock prices jumped after October 7 and has increased in long-term terms by over 10% in the 2 years since the genocide began. Dozens of firms around the world, hundreds even, are turning handsome profits from selling arms and armaments to the Israelis. within Israel itself, the technology sector, you don't have to be a genius to work out what that technology is about, has made serious profits. The Tel Aviv Stock Exchange has increased its market value by $225.7 billion since October 7. An enormous jump in the profits of Israeli industry. But this supply chain for genocide reaches far beyond America. It reaches our own shores. It penetrates the suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne. So people probably know high-tech fighter jets, the F-35s, use vital parts that are manufactured exclusively in Australian factories. These are the parts which Penny Wong had the gall to describe as non-lethal parts, as if the trigger of a gun doesn't actually kill somebody.
Yeah.
But research shows that it goes beyond this. So some research shows that 155 millimeter artillery shells manufactured by Thales Australia in Australia are exported to Israel via a third party of the United States. So the government claims, oh, we're selling them to the United States, but we know where those end up. But it's not just the Australian companies. The Australian state, like the American state, plays a significant role in assisting Israel. For one, some of the F-35 parts that have been exported directly to Israel during this genocide are not just, you know, exported by the factories and, you know, they're just allowed to happen. Some of them have been F-35 parts from the Royal Australian Air Force's own F-35 stockpile in the Northern Territory that are exported to help our ally, Israel. Pine Gap, which is the remote Northern Territory surveillance base, does surveillance on the Middle East, which it gives to the US National Security Agency, who then give it to Israel. So intelligence which is collected here on our shores is being used by Israel to target the Palestinians. And ultimately, all of the export permits for Australian businesses to sell weapons and parts of weapons to Israel are approved by the Australian Department of Defence, which is headed up by Richard Miles. So the infrastructure that physically enables a genocide to take place, that assembles and loads the guns that Israel uses, is actually indistinguishable from the major institutions of capitalism. It's indistinguishable from the main states of capitalism, like the United States, and the main corporations at the kind of top of the rich list. There's not some separate structure going on that's oppressing the Palestinians. It's the work of international capitalism. But I want to talk about things beyond sort of corporate and state support. I think complicity in the Gaza genocide infects basically every mainstream political institution of our system, including the ones that we're told are supposed to be the checks and balances on power. So the reformist and the liberal political parties, journalists, broadcasters, the education system, the universities, all these things that we're told they're there to make the world nicer are also complicit in the Gaza genocide. And I think the institutional consensus that exists for supporting Israel is an indication of how centrally important this question is to the system. So to start with the political parties, like obviously it doesn't, probably shouldn't surprise anybody that someone like Donald Trump cheers on an ethno-state that murders Arabs. It's probably more surprising, and I think actually a more damning indictment on the entire system of capitalism, that all of the nice guys support this as well. It shouldn't be lost on us that it's the Labour Party here, it's the Labour Party in Britain, and it was the Democrats in the United States who were at the forefront of supporting Israel throughout the entire genocide up until Trump was elected. It's the Labour Party in Britain that is calling Palestine Action terrorists, proscribing them for putting paint on a warplane while actual warplanes are murdering real-life people in Gaza. That is what Labour is doing in Britain. And Labour here, like, fuck me, don't get me started. Like, they've lied shamelessly to the public about sending weapons parts to Israel. They maintained for months on months on months that none of this was happening. It's all a fantasy. It's all fake news made up by the Greens or something like that. But they have kept arming the Israelis. An ABC report from a few days ago said there are 48 active export permits from Australia to Israel that have been reviewed by the Labour Party. They've looked at them and they've said, it's fine for us to keep sending these to Israel. And Richard Miles is actually still lying. He's still saying, no. The ABC, they're lying. It's fake news. You know, even though Penny Wong obviously has kind of let the cat out of the bag. Where am I? Well, yeah, Chris Minns, like, I mean, I think Josh did a pretty good job of skewering him last night. But this is the guy who, at the beginning, projected the Israeli flag onto the Opera House, then when another monument of Sydney was appropriated by us to fight against a genocide, he tried to block us. Like, this guy, from the beginning to the end, no matter how many people have starved, no matter how many people have been massacred, still backs up Israel. The Labour Party, we shouldn't forget when they talk about starvation, the Labour Party in February 2024, the Australian Labour Party, cut funding to the UN Relief Works Agency. They said, oh, they're Hamas. That's literally their justification for cutting funding to the main agency which supplied aid to the Palestinians in Gaza. And so when they talk about starvation, oh, it's a crime that starvation is being used as a weapon of war, they use starvation as a weapon of war when they cut the aid to the Palestinian people 18 months ago. And of course, the Labour Party appointed Gillian Siegel, this fucking Israel lobbyist, to be judge, jury, and executioner on the question of who is allowed to speak out for Palestine and who isn't. But why? I think for Labour, and the fundamental reason why, is that running capitalism means accepting the competition between empires, which means fulfilling Australia's role as a loyal ally of the United States, as their sidekick, and of Israel as a part of that. I think it shows that there's certain rules of the game that are unchallengeable. The fact that all of the parties on both sides of politics accept the question of imperialism in the Middle East, of supporting Israel, shows that there are some things that you have to accept if you want to run the system, and this type of thing is one of them. I think it's the same reason that Albanese buckles basically to whatever Trump says, like, oh, give us another $800 million for those submarines. Yes, sir, I'll do that. Open up, anyway. It's the same reason that they're so they appear so craven when it comes to the question of this relationship with the United States. It's actually, it's so fundamental to Australian capitalism. And it's just too important to rock the boat, even if they're committing a genocide. Another institution which I think reflects this as well is the media, who have just been like absolutely criminal. Like, the mainstream press basically reads like the press releases of the Israeli State Department. They just pump out whatever fucking propaganda that they say, on and on and on, no matter how many people have been massacred. They're constantly talking about this self-defense argument. From the beginning, it was the way that they justified it, and they held to it for a long, long time. And of course, they've attacked the movement as anti-Semitic. They've written many articles about Josh Lees and so on, trying to slander us, basically, as anything but people who want to stand up to one of the worst crimes that we've seen in our lifetime. But I think we have to be clear with the media, just like we have to be clear with the political parties. It's not just the big corporate media that's controlled by the billionaires, by people like Rupert Murdoch, that have done this. It's been the independent public broadcaster who've been some of the main attack dogs against the Palestine movement, the main people justifying Israel's offensive, the main people slandering the movement as anti-Semitic and so on. It wasn't Channel 7, it wasn't The Australian that sacked Antoinette Latouf. It was the ABC. And what was her crime? Sharing a post from the Human Rights Watch. Yeah. Like one of the most moderate NGO organisations in the entire world that was saying Israel is committing war crimes in Gaza. That was her crime, telling the truth, and it was the ABC. And so again, it's both sides of the mainstream which have defended Israel. And I think all of this is a sign. It's not just bad apples. It's not just that the wrong people are in power. There's something about that position of power which demands consensus on this question. There's something fundamental and systemic about the nature of Australia's relationship with Israel that is causing this sort of political convergence. The list goes on and on. Like, I'm a university student. Like, we've had a lot of run-ins with the universities over this. But they're places where it's told, like, you get to go, you're going to make the world a better place, you're going to do enlightening research. Monash, where I go, like, the slogan is change it for the better, or make a change for the world. But they've taken $263 million from defense industry in the last 5 years for research. They're doing research for the US Navy to make their fighter jets better, research which is going to be shared with Israel, who operate the exact same fighter jets. The University of Melbourne, $2 billion they're investing in building a weapons research specific campus at Fisherman's Bend. $2 billion for a fucking weapons campus. That's what our enlightened universities are doing. And so it's no surprise then that people who dissent against all of this get cracked down on. So there's been like WorkSafe reports which have come out to say that there's rampant anti-Semitism on the campus. And then when you look at the evidence, is that there's flags with Arabic writing on them, like extremely anti-Semitic for there to be Arabs, apparently. There's been claims that wearing keffiyehs causes distress to people, like as if we should be caring about the opinions of people who want to defend a genocide and their feelings, while hundreds of thousands of people are being massacred and millions of people are being starved. Obviously, like, you know, the list kind of goes on, and there's a People's Inquiry into Free Speech on Campuses, which basically found that there's systematic attempts to intimidate and punish pro-Palestinian activists. But again, it reflects these institutions, which we're told are supposed to be the checks and balances on power, have just ended up as bad, and in some instances actually worse, I think, than the sort of main bad guys that we usually identify. And so what does this tell us? Like, all of the mainstream institutions of capitalism, whether they're conservative, whether they're liberal, whether they're social democratic, are deeply implicated in the Gaza genocide. That's why the title of the talk is not parts of the system are to blame for the Gaza genocide. It's the whole system that's to blame. That goes, like I've said, through the direct arming and financing of Israel, through to the research and development that's done at our universities, and then the manufacturing consent for the crimes of the State of Israel and suppressing dissenters. And I think there's like a couple of things that I wanted to draw out from that aspect. And like one of them is that all of the things that we're told are avenues for reforming the system are absolute dead ends. Like if they're incapable of dealing with literally the worst atrocity that any of us have seen in our lifetime, they're not going to reform away the fundamental problems of the system that we live in. But also, it's just a complete indictment on them as institutions, like genocide. We're taught, very rightly so, that the Holocaust was the worst crime of the 20th century, and yet we're seeing a new one unfold before our eyes, and all from head to toe, all of the institutions of society, all of the people that rule us, everywhere their authority is, they just accept it, they defend it, and they attack the people who stand up against it. It's a complete indictment on the entire system. It is absolutely rotten. And all of us like see like how fucking twisted what is happening in Gaza is. All of us are motivated to take political action about that. All of us thinking, how can this be? And yet down the line, the institutions that rule us are okay with it. And I think it shows you can't take over the structures of society as they are with good intentions. We have to tear it down and we have to rebuild it anew. But I wanted to talk about something else, which is how capitalism is to blame in a more fundamental sense than just the fact that the institutions of the system are backing up this genocide. I think if you want to understand not just the fact that, yes, Lockheed Martin is profiteering off this, yes, America is sending weapons, you have to understand what's driving that. And I think that it's being driven by the basic dynamics of the capitalist system. Marxists argue that imperialism, not just the cashing in on missiles, but the competition between nation states to dominate the world, is a part of the system's DNA. And ultimately, it's imperialism, this rivalry to dominate parts of the world between big, powerful states, that's the root cause of the Gaza genocide. Well, why is this part of the system's DNA? Well, I think for corporations to sell their goods to the world markets, they have to have armies and governments which are committed to keeping open trade routes with battleships and, you know, today with high-tech jets, drones, whatever. Dominating parts of the world can mean having access to and control over crucial resources. And rivalry over who gets to have this control is ultimately settled by force. It doesn't matter if you have a giant economy if you don't have giant guns to defend it. So this scramble for who gets to be the top dog dominates the way that our world looks. There's a reason why it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution had happened that we had industrial wars like the First and Second World War, where all of society was turned over to annihilating human life and redividing the world amongst states. It is a product of capitalism that that exists. People probably know that there's been like basically not a single day of peace since the Industrial Revolution took place. And a way of thinking about it is just how corporations are forced to compete against one another so that their rival doesn't win out against them, so that they don't lose market share. Capitalist states are forced to continually build up their arsenals. They say it's, you know, preventing war, like, oh, we need to invest in all of these weapons to prevent war, but actually all of it just makes war more likely. And so in this kind of general setup, the Middle East is a massive epicenter of global imperialist competition. It's at a crossroads for international commerce, which links Asia, Europe, and Africa. And since the discovery of oil in the early 20th century, which is basically the single most important commodity both for energy and for manufacturing, the region has been extremely hotly contested. You know, pro-capitalist propagandists say, oh, the Middle East, there's all of this conflict because of, like, you know, age-old religious conflicts or something like that. But the real reason is commerce, oil, and the scramble to control those things. Our rulers openly admit that this is why they're neck deep in the Middle East. Anthony Albanese, when he justified Australia's participation in the British-American bombing of Yemen in 2024, said in a press conference, "The Houthis are threatening lives, the global economy, and the free flow of commerce in the region's critical waterways." That was his justification for why the poorest country in the world was bombed by the richest countries in the world, smashed to smithereens to protect the free flow of profits. In the 1990s, very infamously, when America went to war with Iraq, a former Secretary of State said, "If Kuwait was selling carrots, we wouldn't give a damn." And so Israel, which is a highly militarized and highly loyal ally in the most, one of the most important regions for world capitalism and imperialism, plays an indispensable role in the West's attempt to dominate. I think all of this stuff, imperialism, actually helps explain why countries like India, like Egypt, like Kenya, who used to be colonized themselves and gained independence, also support Israel. It's because they're part of the Western bloc too, and so whatever goes, so long as it advantages them. An indication of Israel's role in this imperialist setup is that after 1967, when Israel went to war with all of its rivals and defeated them in 6 days, it doubled its size overnight, proved that it had military superiority, the ability to defeat the West's rivals. It gained, like, basically a free money button from the West. So the year after that, America increased the aid by 450% in 1968, and in the decade after that, it continued to increase year on year on year. In the words of former US Secretary of State Alexander Haig, Israel became the largest American aircraft carrier in the world that cannot be sunk. And I think that raises an important sort of point, which is that the aggression that Israel carries out is not actually an embarrassment for the West. They might act like it is, but it's part of the appeal. They like the fact that they have an ally that can go around brutalizing anybody that crosses their path. And you can see this dynamic at play recently when Israel carried out the bombing of Iran, one of the main enemies of the West in the region. The German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, he just said, "Israel is doing the dirty work for us." That's literally what they say about Israel. So imperialism is central to capitalism, and Israel is central to imperialism. I think this is the fundamental root of why all of the institutions of our society are implicated in the genocide in Gaza. And I think because of that, like what happened with Vietnam before, the scale of the crime and the just uncritical nature with which our society backs them has demonstrated the real priorities of the system in sharp relief. There's nothing, I think, more in my lifetime that has proved what capitalism is all about. But I don't have that much time left, so I just wanted to talk about some of the really important political implications of this analysis. I think the first thing to say is a movement to free Palestine that doesn't attempt to confront that massive institutional support for Israel is doomed. Israel can't just do it because of what's happening on the ground over there. It can only do it because of the Americans, because of the Australians, because of the British, because of that global system. So we have to confront that. We have to fight like hell, not just to show our moral solidarity with the Palestinians, which is like absolutely important. If you've seen those pictures of kids thanking the Harbour Bridge March from the refugee camps in Gaza, but also a duty to fight against the role that our own ruling class plays in enabling this to be possible. But I think beyond that, a movement that doesn't restructure the entire world so that it is no longer divided up into competing states that will do whatever they can, no matter who it tramples over, in order to make themselves richer and more powerful, unless we can restructure that, there's going to be more Gazas. There's going to be Gaza after Gaza after Gaza, like there was in the 20th century before it. And I think we should also learn the lesson that all of the proper channels are just completely useless, and at worst, they're actually a part of the problem. And so what's happening in Gaza has to be a rallying cry for a bold, combative, anti-capitalist movement that confronts the institutions of global capitalism, doesn't try to take charge of them. And I think these are lessons that we need to take into all of our other fights as well. There's lots of other issues in capitalism where we should learn the lesson. The official channels cannot help us. The ruling class has no morality to appeal to. We have to fight these people, and we actually have to fight for a world where they do not get to make the decisions anymore. But I think that the last thing that I wanted to say, which is not really about how the capitalist system is to blame, but I think is a really important lesson from what we've seen, is that hope lies with the mass of ordinary people. Like, I've talked about how there's a unilateral ruling class consensus around the question of supporting Israel. Like, all of the media, all of the education system, all of the political parties, all of them have been saying support Israel, and yet billions of people around the world reject that and they say, no, I know that this is wrong. I know that there is nothing that can justify the massacring of innocent people in Gaza. This is a case of oppressed and oppressor. Millions of people can see that despite every institution telling them otherwise, and that is an absolutely monumental step forward, I think, for our side. Mm. 3/4 of Australians have a negative view of Israel. Yeah. Like, no government in the history of our country has ever been elected on that majority. Yeah. It's absolutely staggering. And I think it has really big implications for who we look to challenge this just despicable setup of world capitalism. Because there's this assumption that, like, you hear it all the time, even from left-wing people, like, people just don't care, people are just apathetic, people are just greedy and self-interested. Like, literally the second largest march for any issue in the history of this city has been to stand with people on the other side of the world who are being genocided and our own government is complicit. Yeah. People are not greedy and selfish and only motivated into holding on to their own little patch against everybody else. Yeah. People are human beings who can see that the system is not serving the masses of us. That is just an incredible testament, actually, to our side and the possibilities that exist to challenge capitalism. Like, it's not the case that, like, all people care about is themselves. And I think a testament to that also is that actually the largest protest in the history of Sydney was against another war carried out in the Middle East by our government. Like, these are the two main things that have mobilised people to fight back against capitalism have been wars where we're not even the main people that are being sacrificed to it. So that says something absolutely, like, glorious, I think, about humanity. And about, you know, ordinary people, not the humanity, in quotation marks, who occupy Canberra or whatever. But I think the other thing that we have to be really realistic about is, like, we have to go further than what we have right now. It's like, you know, like, the Harbour Bridge March is, like, this just absolutely brilliant thing. But it's, like, the brilliance of, like, a little infant who's, like, pulled themselves up for the first time and, like, standing on their own legs. But it's, like, we want that to grow up into an adult who can run. And that means that we have to absolutely celebrate the massive step forward that's been taken. But we need politics if we want to go further than that. It's not enough to just have marches. Iraq proved that it's not enough to have marches. And I think the fact that Albanese has responded to this by, yes, a shift, but not conceding to any of the demands of the movement, means that we need to keep building. And we need politics to know what we can do next. Socialists have an argument that we need to look to the power of the organised working class. That is a really big part of our politics. Because we can't just demonstrate and, you know, block the centre of a city for a day, which is epic, and I really wish that I was at that. But also that we can throw a spanner in the war machine at the point of production, where all of the wealth is created. And you've seen that in little glimpses all across southern Europe, in France, in Italy, in Spain, in Greece, where dock workers have said, our labour is not going to contribute to the genocide. We refuse to ship any military parts to Israel while it carries out this genocide. That is something that's more difficult to ignore than just a demonstration. But that's an untapped power. Like, it would be awesome if in Sydney dock workers could have, you know, stopped work and prevented those F-35 parts being sent to Israel. That's a possibility, but we need organisation to put that into practice. And that is one of the, you know, great responsibilities that I think falls on all of our shoulders. And it's like, we have to have politics, we have to have strategy, which is what this weekend is about, but then we have to have organisation that can translate those good ideas and those bold visions for what society can be into practice, because the reality is small numbers of people cannot do it. we have a global system of capitalism. We have the United States Empire to confront. And that is basically the duty that I think falls on our shoulders. So I'll leave it at that. But yeah, thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.